We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. It is our post-mortem show, part three.
Tonight, Michael and I are going to be joined by Mason Ginsberg and Jason Calmes. Mason, Jason. Mason is our resident power rankings guy, and I'm going to challenge him. Do you think he's going to be scared, Michael?
I think what he would be scared of is if we combine the two guests, because I would love to see Mason do a power rankings of top beards and where Jason Calmes would rate on that. I mean, you got the Harden beard, you had the Mavericks beard that all got shaved after the Hornets lost to them. You know, you got some pretty impactful beards, both present and past. I would love to see where Jason's beard ranks on Mason's power rankings.
I don't know. Jason's right up there with, like, all-time greats, like Blackbeard the Pirate. I think he could give him a run for his money.
Yeah, I'd like to see a Genghis Khan Jason matchup in our Hornets 24/7 or whatever our new site is going to be, you know, a beard tournament this summer.
Yeah, so by the way, just you've deeply offended me there, because Genghis Khan, how do you know he even had a big bushy beard? Mongolians get, like, wispy things.
Have you not seen Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure? I based almost all of my historical facts on that movie.
So great.
Exactly.
All right, so let's get Mason on to answer some questions here. And we're joined now by Mason Ginsberg, the author of the player rankings for the Hornets this year. We're bringing on Mason so I can call him out. Mason, are you ready to be called out?
Bring it on.
Your player rankings has Ryan Anderson number one, which Michael, you know, he basically predicted. He said Ryan Anderson was going to be the MVP this year. I think you're wrong. I think Anthony Davis was the most important player to this team this season. How wrong do you think I am?
I mean, he's second in my rankings, so it's not an argument that can't be made. Anthony Davis has arguably been a more impactful player on both sides of the ball. Anderson's defense has never been his forte, and his rebounding numbers, his offensive rebounding in Orlando was pretty solid. I think his numbers have slipped from the rebounding perspective a little bit this year, but I just think he's been the most consistent offensive option for the Hornets, and and the Hornets are in the top half of the league in offensive efficiency, and he's a big reason why. You also can't discount the fact that Anthony Davis has missed some games. Anderson's played in almost all of them. I think he missed one because he was sick, and that's the only game he's missed all season. So that's another important factor. But I mean, Davis, his efficiency rate, I think his PER is higher than Anderson. So in terms of production while on the court, sure, I could definitely see Anthony Davis being ranked higher than Ryan Anderson.
Yeah, there's something about Anthony Davis. He just does so much more than Anderson does that I have a hard time saying Anderson is more impactful. I mean, yeah, he is. I said it on one of our guests on earlier. He shot like 50% of the three-pointers when he was on the floor. He was a huge offensive focus, but Anthony Davis was extremely efficient offensively. He actually averaged more points per shot than Ryan Anderson. He was a way better rebounder on both ends of the floor. He got steals. He got blocks. They're not very different assist-wise. And, yeah, so Anderson played a few more games, but Anthony Davis, I felt like when he came on the floor, the game changed. And I didn't feel that way when Ryan Anderson was out there all the time.
Well, win shares per 48 minutes would agree with you. He, far and away, was the leader for the Hornets, unless you count Hakeem Warwick's 7 minutes played for the Hornets.
Hakeem's a special case. We'll keep him for the Hall of Fame discussion we'll have about him later.
Yeah, it's funny because I look at Basketball Reference and see it and sort by PER, and the top two players are Henry Sims and Hakeem Warwick, and then you have Anthony Davis third. Anthony Davis win shares for 48 is, 0.159 as compared to 0.126 for Anderson. And Anderson's even tied for Robin Lopez for second there. So, I mean, there are tons of stat categories. There's tons of examples that would lead to Davis, getting that top spot. And, I still have one more set of rankings coming out. I'm going to do them Thursday since Wednesday's our season finale. But I'm not sure who I'm going to put at the top yet. But we'll see. You've already started to make a convincing argument, and I'll weigh everything and take a look, and we'll see.
All right. So if you put Anthony Davis at the top, you need to apologize.
I'm not sure I'm ready to apologize for anything. I will willingly cite you and our conversation right now, but I see no reason to apologize.
So another guy that you've had at or near the top pretty much all season is Gravis Vasquez. And, I mean, you can't blame you. A lot of this has to go on numbers. Of course, you use eye test as well, but numbers-wise, Vasquez is putting up a season that few expected. But recently, we've seen Brian Roberts get his share of minutes with Vasquez going down, or with Monty just preferring Roberts because he needed a little bit more quickness at the point guard position. Throw all stats out of the way. Just go on eye test. Let's say since the All-Star break, how far apart do you really think Vasquez and Roberts are when you take everything into consideration?
I love hearing this question coming from you because we heard some Roberts hate earlier this season, but I do think this question is probably more based on Gravis Vasquez than it is Brian Roberts. I've liked what I've seen from Roberts, especially in the second half of the season, and we have seen Roberts playing more point guard with Gravis playing on the wing some, but I like Vasquez, and I think we're on the same page. And Mike, you and I have been on the same page for a while about this, that he's not the answer at point guard long term for the Hornets. And that we're both big Bledsoe fans. We've discussed other options, but I think Gravis is better than Roberts at getting teammates the ball, putting teammates in position to score. But I think Vasquez is the better player, but I don't think the gap is as wide as, I think before the season, even though we didn't expect this from Vasquez, we did expect Vasquez to be the far superior player to Brian Roberts. We didn't even know, most of us didn't even know who he was. He was this guy from the summer league team who put up some decent numbers. And I think the gap is much closer than any of us would have expected.
So number 11 on your last list, Austin Rivers.
Uh-huh.
He's had some, articles saying he's had the worst, you know, basic season ever of any NBA player. I got to listen to the Bill Simmons Chad Ford podcast because, of course, I'm now absorbing every draft nugget I can. And they were laughing about Austin Rivers and how awful he was. You have him 11th on the team ahead of Darius Miller and Xavier Henry. Is he having the worst NBA season of anybody ever?
I don't think it's fair, though, to laugh at his season. If you haven't watched him, I guarantee you Bill Simmons hasn't watched much of Austin Rivers play. And it's I really have a hard time saying he's having the worst season of all time, especially seeing what he did after the All-Star break. The guy made strides, and you saw it most in that game before he got hurt and that injury ended up ending his season. He looked a lot better. Whether or not that means he's going to turn into a you know, decent NBA player down the line remains to be seen. He's still got to learn how to finish at the rim. That's far and away the most important thing for him to fix. But with the rankings perspective, it's a lot about minutes, and I wasn't comfortable putting Xavier or Darius ahead of. Well, Xavier's he should be. I should probably put it. I don't even remember if he's at the bottom, but he needs to be. I think Rivers is. I mean, he's a better player than Xavier Henry, because Xavier Henry does one thing well. It just gets to the free throw line, and he can't make free throws. So, I mean, what are you going to do with that? I definitely do not think that Rivers has had the worst season of all time. I think that's a vast exaggeration. You have to really watch him and understand, you know, what he's learning, and he's working hard, and I think he can improve.
Yeah, I have a hard time with Rivers. I can't figure out which way I want to go with him. But I get to write an entire article about him. So I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. So when he was healthy, when Jason Smith was healthy, the Hornets had four of the top six, sometimes four of the top five guys on your power rankings were all bigs. I guess just take me through how you saw that unit work together and what would be your plan moving forward. Would you just keep these four guys together? Would you shift roles? Would you bring another type of big in? What would be your plan, you know, with the frontline position?
Oh, it's tough, and the Hornets have a very difficult decision to make about this, because I've been trying to look a lot recently. Robin Lopez, we all know his big issue has been his defensive rebounding. The numbers, the raw numbers say he's a very poor defensive rebounder. He's pretty solid on the offensive glass, but he doesn't get any defensive rebounds. However, I was comparing rotations and looking at which big men, with or without on the all the big men on the court, what kind of impact it has on the team's rebounding numbers. And far and away, even more than Anthony Davis, the biggest negative impact for defensive rebounding was when Robin Lopez left the court, which amazed me. And so I have a theory, and I wrote about it a little bit in the preview today, that maybe Robin Lopez is more of a guy that just focuses on finding his man and boxing out and not worrying as much about going up and grabbing a rebound. I don't really have much in terms of an eye test. I really haven't had enough time to look at that in depth, but the numbers do support the fact that as a team, the Hornets do rebound better with Lopez on the court than without him. However, the Hornets have four really good big men, and they have pretty much trash on the wings. And I think if I'm the Hornets, you have to look at moving one of those big men. And I think Lopez is the guy. Unfortunately, he seems like his value is, it might be as high as it's ever going to be right now for because his sufficiency numbers look good. He's gotten a lot of minutes for the Hornets, more than he ever got with Phoenix. I think you have to look at moving him if you can get some decent value in return. And that would be the route I would take. They have a lot of good big men, and they just, I don't think they have quite enough minutes to go around for the rotation as is. And another thing they could look at doing, which I wrote about in my Aminu piece, is if they look at bringing Aminu back, they could potentially play him at the four a little bit. I think his game is better suited for something like that, but you know, that's all speculation. He's not even under contract for the Hornets next year. But I think my one move would be, if they can get something decent in return, to look to move Lopez.
Do you think Jason Smith can play center for long minutes?
I think so. He's been pretty good defense. I think his defensive numbers on off splits look pretty good this year. And he was playing a good bit of center because, as we know, Monty Williams didn't want to expose Davis to the interior, to the beating he'd be taking against some of the bigger centers, which I don't agree with. But I was actually talking with Jake at the game today. Seeing Anthony Davis in a suit, my goodness, the guy's a twig. You don't notice it when he's in uniform, but when he's in a suit, I don't know what the difference is, but when he's in a suit, it's absurd how skinny the guy is. But I do think Smith can play some minutes at center, and I think Davis will play more minutes at center as he starts to, put on pounds.
How about, we're talking about moving Lopez, maybe if you bring Aminu back, shifting him to some minutes at power forward. How about Lou Amundsen? If you could bring him back on a cheap contract, would he be good enough to be your fourth or fifth big for an entire season? And that could that make somebody like Lopez even more expendable?
I like Lou. I think as a fourth big man, you're stretching it. But he'd be an ideal fifth big. He'd be great. I'm not sure if I'd pay him more than $1 to $1.5 million a season, but I think what he brings on defense is fantastic. He really moves well. I'm not sure he's a truly great post defender, but he's a great help defender. He knows where he's supposed to be and when he's supposed to be there. He's pretty good on the glass. I know the Hornets were looking at him, I think, before he signed with Golden State, but they've liked him for a while, and hopefully he wants to stick around. I don't see him as more than a fifth big. He'd be a weak fourth big, but a very strong fifth big.
You don't care that he's 30?
Not really. Not if he's not with the role he'd be playing for the Hornets now.
Yeah, I've had people, they want an all-young team, but, you got to have a few veterans on the squad who are older than that. And that way also when, the announcers are talking, they can't say, well, this team's not very good because they're the youngest team in the league. Get tired of it.
Yeah, ratchet that up. And then how about, all the big guys we talk about, and, obviously what we do at certain positions is going to have a lot of impact on this team next year. But to me, a lot of the fringe guys are so interesting. And Darius Miller, second round pick. We got that pick as kind of a throw-in in that Okafor-Ariza trade that I'm still trying to figure out why Washington did. But, your best guess, is he on this team next year? And if so, what's kind of the ceiling you see for him?
I think so. If you'd asked me a month ago, I would have been pretty skeptical. But he's gotten some minutes to show what he can do, and he's really showed he's got a pretty versatile skill set, I think. He's not a really super athlete, but he continues to show me some pretty solid passing. He can knock down threes. I think his versatility, he's kind of exactly what we heard about him before the draft. Like, he doesn't do any one thing great, but he does a lot of little things well. And I think that there's a spot for him on this team next year. And I think they'll at least give him one more year to try to look and see what he can be. I'm not sure his upside is that tremendous, but if he can, I think he seems like a hard worker. And if he can show some defensive improvement, he can be maybe like a 3-and-D type player. But I do like Miller, and I like all the different things that he brings. His rebounding probably needs to get a little better too. For his size, his rebounding is a little disappointing, but I think those are all things that he can work with the coaching staff in the offseason and get better at.
Got one last question for you, Mason.
Sure.
If Eric Gordon had played the entire season, but played at about the level he did while he's been playing, which is not what we wanted, where would he have landed in your rankings?
Oh, man, that's tough. He probably would have passed Lopez, but it's tough to say if he's been – because if he'd been – even this would have been an even bigger disappointment if he had played all season and played like this, I think. While the health it would have been nice that he didn't get hurt. His style of play has still been left a lot to be desired. He keeps settling for these Josh Smith-type long twos, doesn't attack as much. When he attacks, he's great, but he probably would have actually landed right around where he is, maybe a spot higher. It would have been hard to justify not putting Grievous ahead of him, though, because He would have been top five still. Maybe top three, but he definitely would not have passed Anderson. Definitely would not have passed Davis. He would have been, you know, right around where Lopez and Grievous were. But I would have been even more disappointed. But in terms of production and contributions to the team, he would probably have still been a top five power rankings kind of guy.
Yeah, I'm having the same thoughts as, like, you know, I really want – I mean, I, for some reason, I just don't feel like the team is going to be able to send him out this summer. I just feel like it's not going to work out. The deal offers they're going to get are not going to be satisfactory. They're not going to feel they want to mortgage anything else to get rid of him, so just bring him back. And I'm just hoping he doesn't show us next year what he showed us this year. And I don't even mean on the injury, just the style of play. If he comes back and he plays that way, this is worst case scenario in a lot of ways for me.
Yeah, I agree. It's the Hornets made an investment in him, and I'm not sure how they feel about him right now. They've been keeping it pretty close to the chest there, but I mean, if you can get his last season in LA before he came here, you just saw so much potential for him, and this has been the last 2 years have been kind of a mess. So hopefully, I kind of agree with you that they're not going to get the offers they're hoping for. And he slightly better odds than 50-50. He'll be back next year. And like you, I hope he can show us what he showed LA before he came here.
So my last question for you, let's say we can't move Gordon, nothing's on the table. Real quickly, give me your dream realistic offseason.
All right. I think we have the same dream about bringing Bledsoe here if it takes Lopez and Vasquez to get it done. I'm not sure LA would pull the trigger on that one, but you know, hope if they would, great. And if being realistic with that draft pick, saying we're, you know, around four or five, assuming Gordon's back, I got to go Otto Porter, bring him in. Re-sign Aminu if it's reasonable, and let him play some four. I really do want to see how he can do. If he works on the off season and they get him, you know, get him in the gym, get him more comfortable with that position, they could put him there, and you know, also have him play some three while you're you know, increasing Porter's minutes throughout the season. And you got Smith there. Hopefully you can bring back Amundsen. I mean, that's the framework of a pretty solid offseason right there, in my opinion. I've been turned off more and more to Brandon Jennings. I'm kind of shying away from thinking of wanting him, and I think he's going to get overpaid by somebody. But Bledsoe would be my dream target. I watched him play Friday night against us, and I like the guy more and more every time I see him play.
Yeah.
All right. No Pekovic.
I'm still not. I like Pekovic. I do a lot, but I'm still not convinced that we need a true center in this day and age of the NBA.
Okay. You and Michael can get together and share drinks over that idea. So thanks very much, Mason, for coming on.
Sure.
And we'll bring you back later in the summer to talk about. You know, all the new acquisitions and what your pre-rankings are going to be.
Nice. Sounds good.
That way we can mock you later when they're all wrong.
That's what it's all about.
Right. All right. Thanks for coming on.
All right. Later, guys.
And now we're joined by Jason Kalmes, 42. He has been following the Hornets and giving everybody updates every weekend about what happened the week and, you know, generally doing a really good job at pointing you to take a look at things that have happened with the Hornets. He also tracks what's happening off the court, kept us up to date on various things that the legislature is doing and also what kind of improvements will be happening at the arena. So, Jason, what is the most exciting thing that's going to happen this offseason with the arena?
I guess I don't have a ruler with small enough gradations for that, but to tell the difference. But at the arena, there's going to be a lot of improvements that fans aren't really going to see directly for the locker rooms and green rooms and suites and stuff that are supposed to influence players and make it a better experience for them where they're at work. And then that kind of stuff also helps bring money in with concerts and things like that. And then they're adding in some new video equipment, better replays in the game, things like this are sort of scant now. More lighting, more effects, better sound, video boards, HD, all that stuff. And then they're reconfiguring some of the seating that doesn't affect a lot of people. Like high level, high end, loge boxes, and they're adding what they call a party perch. And you're supposed to have some live music in some of the games or all the games. So doing that sort of stuff. But it's going to make it a lot of it is sort of guts of the arena types of improvements to keep it up to standards with the NBA.
All right. So are they installing a giant TV that will be so big that when you take a full court shot at the end of halves, it hits the TV?
No. I think it'll be much more reasonable and far less annoying. I think it'll say we're classy, not we're ostentatious.
Can't imagine any team in any league that would be ostentatious.
Right. No. At least not on this side of the Mississippi River. So there's that. And then the other big thing is the practice facility. The Hornets are finally getting a practice facility.
Yeah, I remember. I mean, back when they first moved, they were supposed to get one, and that kind of whole went by the wayside for various reasons, most involving George Shen. But,
well, the state was also sort of messing with them. The governor at the time wasn't terribly friendly to either of the sports teams. And then Shen sort of gave the promise back in exchange for the attendance benchmarks, which is a little bit overlooked. But they're actually building it, and they've added the office space that's walled in, and then the practice facility is up with steel structure. Girders and all that other stuff is up, and it's all supposed to be done by September, according to the contractor. So... And that'll be really good because that's a discriminator when you look at when you're a free agent. You know, if you go to play and say, well, all these other teams have this and you don't have it, it sort of makes you look behind. It's sort of this way it just makes you look like you're in the pack, right? And now you have a fairer shot at free agents and things like that, keeping those guys happy.
So the team's kind of in a unique, well, not kind of, I mean, it's a very unique position in which the team is owned by an owner who also owns the local NFL team. I guess overall, marketing standpoint, ease of, I guess what I'm asking, good and bad, what are some of the pros and cons of having an owner who has that kind of relationship with two major sports franchises in one city?
So one of the reservations about people have with Benson buying the team was that somehow the Hornets or now the Pelicans would be Saints Jr. I don't even really know what that means. This guy hires people to run these things for him. And they generate a certain amount of money each. So the amount of attention that Benson needs to place on it is, I'm not really sure, really can be divided, right? He has the same CFO, Dennis Lauscher, looking at both things and his car dealerships, media empire that he has now, and banking institutions. So, I mean, I know this is a big money thing, but I think his attention's already divided. So I don't really see that con manifesting itself. In terms of a pro, the pros, it seems like he can approach businesses now and say, if you have a relationship with me, I can give you even more. Like, because before, it's a Saints experience. Here is pretty big. The NFL is big, but it's not that often. Now you get with me, and we can give you that. Plus, if you pay a little more, we can give you 41 Hornets games and things like this. And it's more year-round, and we can create more interesting opportunities for you. I mean, he already has lots of relationships with competing franchises, with competing businesses within the Saints. They have Coke has the pool rights at the Dome, but they have Gatorade, which is a PepsiCo product, their official sports drink, for instance, with the Saints. But PepsiCo now has the pool rights at the arena. So, I mean, he can play big companies off of each other because he has more to play with. This can only, I think, help both franchises together. You know, and when you, in terms of not just financial markets, but player markets, if this is a unique situation, this is a guy that not only is looking for an NBA title, he can point to a Lombardi trophy and, you know, other success and have a giant indoor practice facility there and other, you know, huge athletes that desire to come in. And Drew Brees is a Super Bowl MVP, worldwide name. I mean, he's right across the parking lot from you. I can only think that that helps, you know, in terms of adding a shine to the organization. So I see that relationship as being very positive for the Pelicans, more positive for the Pelicans than for the Saints.
So let me ask you just a general question, because I noticed you in one of the comments on our site. You know, we're talking about Benson and how he's going to lose money this year, essentially, with the Hornets.
Yep.
But here's the whole – there's been that – there's a new CBA that goes into effect this coming offseason. And we have seen teams selling for crazy money now. I mean, the Hornets were sold for $320 million. And I think, was it Philly sold for 280? I mean, it was a really low number. And now we're seeing teams that, you know, they're lining up to buy the Sacramento Kings, and both sides are throwing numbers in the 520s and 550s for majority stakes. So it's not even the whole price of the team they're paying for. So clearly this CBA really gave the owners a massive advantage, much more than anyone really knew, and clearly the players' union got completely taken to the cleaners by this offseason, or the offseason before. So is Tom Benson actually at threat to lose money going forward with the new CBA?
So I think no, in the long run, provided it's run correctly. So a couple things. So the Hornets were sold for $338, slightly more than what you quoted. And then the $525, now $550, that Ballmer raised the price to, is the total valuation of the team. The Malouf share is like a $300 million thing. But yeah, that valuation for the team would exceed the highest that there was prior to that. So I mean, it would be a record. It would be a record if that went through. The CBA clearly shifted a lot of money to the owners. So 7% of $4 billion going 30 ways. So what is that? $4.4 billion, a little bit less than that, so 280, so maybe about $10 million an owner. But the tax rules really also go in there and take a lot of money from the high payroll teams like the Lakers and divide it up as a pool for the other owners to get at. But Benson had to shell out a ton of money this season to fix a whole bunch of problems. Rebranding isn't free. He had to do that. The Rashard Lewis, he had to pay Rashard Lewis money to play for another team, right? So there's all these other things that were particular to this season that are just going to cost him to lose that money. And he's investing that money so that he can start making actual money sooner. But in the long run, this is supposed to be at least a break-even prospect for the owners, profitable if they run it right. You know, and not just profitable like I made a penny, but like actually a worthy business investment. It was before these things were viewed as sort of luxury items. You know? But if you look at it from the point of view of when Benson got in, apparently he got in before the prices started skyrocketing. So, I mean, that's a good thing. You know? But part
I'd
of it,
much rather have him than Steve Ballmer going after the team.
Well, that's one of the things. I mean, Ellison offered a lot more than 338. But that's, and then you would have had to pay to relocate and all these other things, but you pay more when you want to relocate a team. That's one reason the Kings' valuation is pretty high.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this year, obviously, Hornets didn't play that well. 2 years in a row now, been amongst the bottom teams in the league. Attendance isn't the worst in the league, but it's not fantastic. Now there's a new brand coming in, a facelift of the franchise. I mean, is it going to be something as simple as winning gets the butts back in the seats, sells out arenas? If so, what type of winning? 500 basketball? Is it going to take, you know, atop the Western Conference like it did in 2007, 2008? Or will that even not be enough? Do you think that the Pelicans need to play a more exciting brand of basketball than they've played under Monty so far in order to really get the city excited?
So I'll say a couple things. One is let's talk about what happened in 2007-2008. In that season, the Hornets were crushing teams like not just champs, but like a dynastic team in January, right? The hard thing to do is to do that all year. But in January, they were just, I think they were 14-1 or something like that, and they won. Their average margin of victory was over 10 points. It was a strong January. And the attendance was horrible. But after that, the attendance started creeping up, and the average for the season ended up being like in the high 14s. The following season, the team was 98% sold out on the season while the Saints were sold out. So people can say, oh, you can't support it, or football has an effect. Football has almost no effect on the sales. It might have an effect on actually going to the game and buying Pepsis. But the winning makes it a little bit of a difference in the current season. It can ramp it up, but it really makes a difference the next season. So if the Pelicans come out strong, they'll see their low attendance numbers, which is what they'll have next season, creep up, and the following season will be very good. So what you need is a good record this year, right? But that's not as important as a good record last year, playoff appearances, playoff wins, right? And then star power, right? The other things that really affect attendance are legacy. We don't have the option to get that in the next couple of years, right? And then also your day of the week and opponents affect your particular games, right? So Miami on a Saturday is better than Charlotte on a Wednesday. So so the brand and all this stuff isn't going to make really a difference. As far as the exciting brand of basketball, I mean, I don't know about you, I thought the alley-oops with Chris and Tyson were very exciting, and I liked our team, but I didn't find the basketball that exciting, right? Like, I thought maybe the Suns were when they were running and all that stuff. I'm assuming that's what you mean, that kind of stuff. So if that brand packs the arena when all you had to do was win and have a star, you have a star or a budding star, all we have to do is start winning, and the people will come. That said, I don't think the attendance is as important as getting the corporate sponsorship. Attendance kind of helps you get that. But you really need the TV deal in place, the public support. We have those two things. it's the corporate sponsorship that's been creeping up. That's really the big deal. But I don't know. What did you think about the Chris Paul, Byron Scott basketball? Did you call it exciting?
I found it exciting. I found Paige Stojakovic from the wing exciting.
Yeah, I don't. I think that we remember highlights. I don't think that the actual 48 minutes of basketball in reality was that exciting. I mean, when you compare it to what fans like to see, like Jason said, you know, with Phoenix or even Golden State, teams like that, it wasn't anywhere near there. You know, it was exciting basketball because it was winning basketball. But yeah, I don't think it was, you know, what the casual fan would consider, you know, the optimum style of basketball.
I do remember some rage over Bobby Jackson and Gennaro Pargo taking over some of my days that season. Because they were really bad at times.
Yeah. The last time you could say that about anybody, either of those guys. So, I mean, so I guess I'm wondering, Jason, your thoughts just overall. I mean, I think with a lot of the other guys on this podcast, we've talked about the players, but I mean, any good franchise really starts at its core. You talked a little bit about the, you know, Tom Benson and what's being set up there with the practice facility, using, you know, the Saints to kind of help out the Hornets in some ways, particularly with corporate sponsorship. Give me your take on Dell and Monty. I mean, they were given a tough deck, you know, of cards these 3 years, with being thrown into the Chris Paul situation and now a rebuild as you're trying to figure out if you have an owner, if you're even going to stay in the city. Okay, now we're going to be in the city, but, you know, who's our owner going to be? And all this, I mean, do you think that we really should grade Dell and Monty on these 3 years? Do they get a bit of a pass? And if so, when are you really going to start looking into these guys and determining whether or not each one of these men are, you know, foundation pieces for the future?
So, I mean, I guess it all depends on what your criteria set is for those two guys. So if your criteria on is, do I have a coach that's going to win me a title, right? Then it's unfair to judge either of them, or a GM is going to help me construct a title team, based on what's been happening for all the reasons you listed. You know, that and they had a mess of a set of books, right? And, you know, Dell has clearly gone in and found ways to try to clean that up as much as possible after doing what he could to do something with next to nothing to keep Chris Paul here, things like that. So if that's what your criterion is, I think you have to give him a pass. At the same time, if what you're saying is, how is this guy going to function in his job and try to detach the wins and the titles from the judgment and try to look at what you have to work with and look at the baby steps he takes, I think Dell is, you know, a top 15 GM without equivocation. I think it would be very hard to argue that he was in the bottom half of GMs. And the same for Monty. Monty has frustrated you and other people with getting this team and other teams to play very hard and to overachieve. You know, even in the Lakers series, the playoff series, they overachieved. He's clearly had a very good rate of developing players. Do all players under him develop? No, because sometimes you fail. It's not a good fit. Sometimes a player is not developable. But he's taken $1 million players and turned them into $3 million players, right, for better or worse. And so I think both of these guys are easy top 15, top half, right? I'm not going to try to peg whether he's 3 or 7 or 11, but I think these guys are worth the extensions they got. And decisions need to be made prior to Anthony Davis getting a big contract as to whether these are the guys to go into those more sensitive years.
So, following that question, Jeff Bauer or Dell Demps?
In a GMing contest or what? Yes, Dell.
I challenge you to come up with a contest that Jeff Bauer is the correct answer. A dance contest?
Pie eating contest. Easy.
So this is, I was going oyster eating, but yes.
Yeah. I'm sorry, that was an obvious one.
Mustache contest?
I bet Dell could grow a mean mustache.
They're a tie in being bald.
That's true.
Right, neck and neck, so.
Oh, all right, so I have one last question for you, Jason.
Sure.
I know you're a David West fan.
Yes.
If the Hornets could trade anybody on this team other than, say, Anderson and Anthony Davis and get David West back, would you do it?
That is a good question. So my reflex is, if I'm trying to be, you know, Pella-centric here and not Jason-centric, if you could get Lopez for West, assuming Davis was sort of big enough to pick up center minutes, then, you know, maybe. But that's just going to push Anderson back farther. So I just don't see it as a fit at this time.
Wow. I expect you to jump all over that and say, David West, your boy, yeah, come back.
I'm stupid. So that's what it boils down to.
Have you watched any Pacers games this year?
No.
Or is it too painful for you?
I don't. No. I just don't. I don't think about it. I mean, and I would pay attention if I thought that they weren't, you know, sitting in front of a meat grinder there in the East, but they are. So, I mean, he's doing what he needs to do. I don't blame him a bit.
So. Yeah. So this is one thing that I've been wondering about, and this is just a natural jump out of your mention about the meat grinder. Is this kind of like a really, it seems to me like a really good time to be rebuilding? Because, like, before the Heat, like, blossomed, and there were, like, teams that you weren't always certain they were going to win. Like, the Lakers and the Celtics, you knew they had finite windows. You knew they weren't going to be dominating forever. The Heat look like they've got this locked down for probably 3 or 4 years where it's going to be really hard to get past that team. So isn't this like the best time possible to be rebuilding?
For a number of reasons, I think so. Not just that, but with the tax rules slamming down. And then, I mean, the situation with Kobe is not pleasant for anybody. But it's going to have huge ripple effect this summer. Right. I mean, with the tax rules slamming down and the Lakers tax bill and the fact that right now they have people in the books this season, they have a pretty hefty roster next season and Dwight's bird rights. But the following season, they have exactly one person in the books, Nash, for just under 10, which means any moves they make this season are greatly going to affect that clean slate they have the following season. They really have to be long term planning now. So now you have a new owner, new tax rules, and you're hurt number one icon, at least in the NBA, that just completely changed everything, right? Your superstar mix is not working. You're paying two coaches. Are you going to pay a third? I mean, something has to happen here, and it's all going to be coming out of LA. And this Kobe thing is just going to make it all the more interesting. And it really makes me wonder, do they need a shooting guard? So.
Everybody's looking. Everyone's got an eye out for a deal for Eric Gordon.
Too soon?
No. No, it's not too soon.
No, but I mean, really. I mean, I'm not saying Kobe for Eric. I'm saying maybe they ship Powell somewhere, right? And then other stuff happens, right? And then Eric to L.A., step three, profit, you know? So, I'm saying that's something that wasn't possible before. It's possible now.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, Jason. So, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Sure.
And we will be talking to you later this summer, I'm sure.
Yep. Talk to you later.